Clark is a Sacramento-based writer and the author of the comic novels Politicians Are Superheroes and The Singularity Survival Guide. His short fiction has appeared in over 50 literary journals, and his nonfiction has appeared in publications including Aereo, The Humanist, The American Spectator, and Free Inquiry magazine. He also runs The Jokes Review, a literary magazine dedicated to outsider art, urban legends, rants, rogue journalism, humor, manifestos, subversive imaginations, bizarro fiction, lowbrow, highbrow mixtures, street art, dangerous ideas, and jokes. We sat down at some point in the long, cold, snowy winter of 2023 to chat about decadence, cities, literature, and a thick, succulent burrito of affiliated topics. Happy listening, you filthy animals.
Peter, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
No worries. Well, look, there's a lot of things we could discuss here. You're something of a Renaissance man. So why don't we start with just a bit of introduction and background. Who Sure. is Peter Clark?
So, you know, I've always wanted to be a fiction writer. That was something that I always pursued. I realized very early on it was something I was likely not going to make any money at, which was probably a smart call. So yeah. I ended up, going the education route, getting probably overeducated. I got a degree in psychology and then a law degree. Really want to practice law. So, I mean, I work in the legal field, kind of like the legal tech space. And I've always, you know, I've written some novels. I've written a million short stories, gotten them published almost everywhere, mostly like small presses. But, you know, my stuff's kind of all over the place. But I came to this realization, and I think that this is something that a lot of fiction writers might run into, is that just I realized no one was reading my work, right? Mm-hmm. And I even have a literary magazine. I run a literary magazine. I care about that world deeply. But yeah. It struck me that after doing this for like 14 years, no one was reading my work. I would, you know, put my life and soul months into like a story, get it published, and then like yeah. you know, 10 people would read it. So at the time, this is going back about 7 years, no, less than that, 5 years. I was the editor at FindLaw.com, a Thomson Reuters company. And I was doing, you know, writing legal articles and editing a group of writers. We were putting out about 100 essays a week, like a lot of content, a ton of content.
Jesus.
It's for their blogs program. So short pieces, you know, 350 words. But it did kind of strike me that, you know, I write nonfiction kind of for my living, my day job. Maybe I'll just try my hand at this. And so I wrote an essay. And it was my first essay I ever wrote, like that was very personal and or not yep. personal, but you know, it was not something professional.
Creative nonfiction.
A creative nonfiction piece. And it was picked up by Quillette, like the very first thing. And they paid me and like it was read by a bunch of people. And I was like, okay, this is a thing. And so I still do write fiction. That is still something that I care deeply about. I have a collection of short stories being published by a small press this year. I'm just finishing a novel. Yada, yada, yada. But like, I have found so much more success literally overnight just from writing essays. And this is kind of a pitch that I give to creative writers all the time now is maybe you're an amazing short story writer or novelist, but like, honestly, use your skills, use your tools as a creative writer to write mm-hmm. nonfiction. Because I think a lot of nonfiction is just screaming for more personality and a more human voice. And that's something that I think creative writers can bring to the table.
Well, these are some things that I grapple with, that I have grappled with, that I continue to grapple with. A lot of what you just mentioned, like my first book, you know, was published, by some clerical error, managed to scoop up some awards, which, if nothing else, means that you can put like a little seal on the cover, makes it look more official, gives it a nice shiny. Finish, but for all the success you can have writing a book, and I've talked to guys who are like a lot of, I wouldn't even say mid-list, just like guys who like write books for a living. Mm-hmm. It's tough. It's a tough business. Like I know the book, so the book, you know, won awards, blah, blah, blah. I have no idea how many people read it because as you can see behind me and there's other bookshelves over there that are not in the purview of the camera. I buy books all the time that I don't read that mm-hmm. essentially amount to like coffee table decorations. And I read some of them, or I'll read like a couple pages, you know, or like get a few chapters in. But it's a real, it's confronting as a writer. It's something I still grapple with. I don't think there's an answer for this, to like think like you spend a year or more writing like a book, short story, you spend a couple months writing this, you put your heart and soul into it. It's a labor of love. And of course, there's this argument, you know, if one person reads it, that's all that matters, or I just wrote it for myself as a cathartic exercise. But I understand what you're saying. Like, it's tough to think, like with the first book, I sold a bunch of copies, but I don't know how many of them were like read cover to cover. So it's confronting, it's drawing.
Well, it's interesting because this is something that's on the minds for a lot of huge authors too, right? Like Sam Harris has talked about this, that he can for sure take 2 years and write a book and it will be read by a couple hundred thousand people. He can in an hour record a podcast, put it out there, and it will be listened to by 500,000 people. And a book is more precious and it has more shelf life. And there's something that is, you know, just inherently more valuable about it. But if you're just talking about influencing people and getting in people's brains, getting ideas out there, I mean, honestly, like a podcast makes more sense if you're someone of his profile. Personally, I think this is someone who's, you know, a million miles below the Sam Harris level of recognition.
Don't knock yourself.
I mean, I think it's important to do everything. I think
I'll add Sam to the
right. Okay, yeah, let's get him in here. I mean, I have a podcast. I have a literary journal. Mm. I have, you know, I write essays and Substack, and you know, I also have a day job. You know, I do have a day job and a child. Like, it's not that hard to really do some of, you know, do a lot of these things. Just like do an article a week and then have different platforms to put it out on, and then have a friend that you do a podcast with. And then all of a sudden it looks like you're super busy, but you're kind of just like, you know, living your life and also being kind of having a creative side hustle. You know, that's my take on what I think the creative people should be doing right now is just a little bit of everything.
It's a good point. No, it's an excellent point about reach, you know, on as far as a podcast goes. It's also, the time is inexpensive. Someone was explaining this to me. Mm-hmm. I was in Venice at the Venice Film Festival, La Biennale. And there was this whole, it's actually on a separate island, like, you know, like 10 meters by ferry, but like it had little tiny little island, I forget the name of it, dedicated exclusively to VR. And they call it immersive theater. And this is, you know, all different kinds of things. People built like VR worlds. There was like interactive things where you're playing with other characters. There was ones where you were like moving around a room so you could like feel shit and like, you know, whatever. You always come up on the, like it's geofenced. So you come up on like a red screen so you know, like you stop walking in that direction or whatever. But anyway, there was like a whole fucking bunch of different kinds of VR. And I interviewed some of the directors of these projects. I may not sound like I have a point here, but I'm coming full circle. So I'm interviewing this one guy, Thomas Villepoe. That episode is forthcoming. I think it's forthcoming. I have to go back and edit parts of it. Anyway, we're basically talking about time, right? And like expensive time versus cheap time. Mm. Time that you spend in a VR headset is extremely expensive because there's no multitasking. It is all consuming. You're not talking to, you know, your spouse. You're not cooking dinner. You're not cradling your child. Like you're like fucking, you are just doing only the VR for that time. You listen to a podcast. You can be on your morning commute. You can be for a run. You can be driving. That time is significantly less expensive because you can consume whatever you can listen to an audiobook, same thing, while, you know, taking your kid for a walk, or kids aren't dogs. I don't know, like doing whatever one does with the child, you know, walk them, pet them, shampoo them. you can, I don't know, like the idea of time being more expensive now. Also, I think we have fucked up our brains as humans now with our attention spans. I certainly did for a while. Now I've deleted all the apps from my phone. I might re-download WhatsApp for when I move to Argentina. But my attention span was horrible. Like I would, because of the reels, I think there was something about that that hasn't been studied, or maybe it has been studied. I don't know. Where I wanted the whole story in like a shorter period of time, and I'm sitting there trying to read like Tolstoy or whatever, and I'm just like, oh, come on, man. Like, I can't deal with you. Like, like, move it along.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know. Have you felt this attention span thing? And then also like the cheap versus expensive time. I totally understand what you mean. Like the podcast, it reaches a lot of people. It takes much less time to produce. It's good to have your hands in lots of things. I didn't even know. There's a couple different questions here. Let's start on Peter's thoughts, because you're a smart guy, on cheap time versus expensive time, and then we can move into some of the other stuff. But like, what do you make of this?
No, I think that that's really right. I mean, I think that one thing that people can do to make their expensive time cheaper is you can do lifestyle changes. So, for example, my most productive time in my life was when I lived in Oakland and worked in Silicon Valley, where I would commute 3 days a week, 2 hours each way to work. And so that was 4 hours that I could do anything I wanted to with that time, that 4 hours. So I read a ton of books, listened to a ton of podcasts.
How? You're driving? Or you're on the train?
No, sorry. I was on the train. I should have made that clear. Yeah. Oh, I was on the train. And I, you know,
maybe you can read while you're driving.
Maybe. Yeah. That's a little terrifying. Maybe when the cars get there. But, and I had a notebook that I wrote half of the short stories that are getting published in this book this year.
Congratulations.
And so that was a thing that like started with me selling my car, because I didn't start out that way. I started doing that commute in my car, and I realized my life was going away. I was seeing my life pass before my eyes, because my days were so truncated between going to work and then coming home, making dinner, and going to bed, right? Because there was so much time I was commuting. The second I freed up my life with that train commute, all of a sudden, my quote-unquote expensive time kind of got very cheap. But I mean, obviously, that's not something that anybody can do. I just think that I mentioned that just to say that I think that there are lifestyle tweaks that people can do to make even that VR headset time more worthwhile. There's another thing that I do in my life that I discovered very early on, just because I've never had very great attention span. I love reading, but my attention span has always been shit, even before like the iPhone came along. And when I was in college, I started doing this where every time I would sit down to study, I would always first pull out a novel. And for about, you know, 10, 15 minutes, nothing crazy, I would just read the novel. That would kind of like quiet my mind, get me into like, you know, more of a space where I'd be able to sit there and study for a while. It would also mean that I could still consume a book every 2 weeks without trying to consume a book. And this is also, to this day, this is how I, for example, keep a literary journal going, is that I don't ever say, here's 5 hours, I'm going to work on my literary journal. I instead, just every time I open up my my email, I have a separate email account for the literary journal, I'll just, you know, open my laptop and then spend 5 or 10 minutes kind of going through the inbox. And so I think that some people who are very anti-multitasking would probably have some criticism of that and say that I'm somehow not doing things correctly. I'm not sure, but it works. It's a thing that I think it keeps me productive more than anything else. And I know so many people who just like can't do a million things. They just have to do like, oh, I just have my day job, I can't do anything else. Like, why not? It's like, just like squeeze it in. Just 10 minutes to 10 minutes a day. You can get a ton done, rather than like thinking you need 5 hours set aside to do any given task. But I do think, I mean, my final thought here is that I do think that there's something kind of profound about the VR that doesn't allow you to truly multitask versus the podcast that does. And I think that this is why possibly AR might be more might be the winning ticket for the next generation of technology rather than VR. Because when you have a AR, maybe, I don't know, whatever Apple comes out when they release some sort of a glass, that will allow you to drive your car, plus check your email, plus call people, plus on and on and on, while maybe experiencing a city like you never have before, because it's also mapping on beautiful art, beautiful murals on the buildings that don't otherwise exist there, whatever the case is, right, with AR. But I think that is kind of an articulation why AR might win the next generation of tech.
I think that's so. A couple things here. I'll work backwards from the last thing we were talking about. Yeah, you know, I mean, everyone thought VR porn, and I asked about this. Everyone thought VR porn was going to be like the bee's knees, and then we're just going to. I don't know, it's kind of disconcerting. Imagine you have like a Her type. If you ever saw the movie Her, well, you have like a fucking Chat GPT powered that's read like every romantic movie and read every Tinder conversation ever. They're like, no, people talk. You can get like a fucking fake virtual partner. You can get like a sex robot to fuck you, and then you can like watch VR porn that like interacts with the sex robot. Like that's freaky, right? And so I don't know. Maybe we're going there. Maybe we're not. I have never had sex with a robot, but I can't imagine it would be as nice with a human. But and you know, programmed to all your fetishes and blah blah blah. But anyway, so I'm interviewing all these directors, and I asked, like, why is VR porn? Like, why are people not? I thought that was going to be huge. And they were like, first of all, it's not that good. Even in Venice, the VR stuff wasn't that good. Like, I mean, I didn't do it. Who am I to criticize? But like, it wasn't as far along as maybe I just assumed that it was. Mm-hmm. And second of all, like, I don't know. It's just not the same to just be like watching VR porn. So I think you have a point about the AR. Like maybe as humans, we'll just be like, yeah, nah. Like maybe I actually want to go to a rave rather than like take MD in my garage and like attend the rave virtually. I think you're onto something there on the winning ticket comment.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be interesting because there are going to be some sub-demographics of people who just do VR porn with a girlfriend. I mean, they clearly exist right now, the whole incel phenomenon. And I mean, in a sense, I want to be not completely cynical about that. I do want to say every human experience is kind of equally valid at some level. Maybe you're not contributing to society, or well, you know, there's a list of things that we kind of expect of humans, right? But at the same time, we have like 8 billion people on the planet, right? And we are more well-rounded as a species if we have people doing a little bit of everything. And I'm kind of okay with those people, in a sense, like doing a self-experimentation on that world and then coming back and telling the rest of us what it's like. There's this guy who I've written about, Wellman, I'd have to look up his name. I've wrote about him for Aereo magazine, actually, where he spent a week in...
Iona's been on here. I actually listened to that episode. Yeah, well, I wrote her because I'm going down to Argentina, and she's like,
"Oh, right, oh,
like Tango Queen." Anyway, that's irrelevant. Continue, please.
Yeah, so I wrote this piece about this guy, was inspired by this guy who spent a week in VR. At this point, many people have done this, but back when he did it, it was like he was one of the first people, maybe the first guy to do it. It's on YouTube where he filmed his experience, just being he would shower. He had a contraption where he would shower in VR with the headset on, that sort of thing.
And then he came back and did a
YouTube video about it. And it was, you know, interesting. And it was interesting to the point where it inspired me to, you know, write this, this, you know, fairly long-winded essay about why VR is kind of comparable to the 18th century decadence movement, where, you know, there's this book called Against Nature by this French author, Wiseman. And he writes about how he was sick of society, sick of everything, sick of life. He went away off into the hills, and it's this very bizarre book where he'll spend chapters upon chapters just talking about how he's just like eating cheese and smelling perfume. He locks himself in a room, just smells perfume for hours because he wants these fake experiences because he thinks that like fake experiences are more valid than real experiences. He doesn't want to smell flowers. He wants to smell perfume, that sort of thing. That's what VR is. And so we are kind of, in a sense, living in a modern decadence movement like the 1800s, writers, kind of discussed. That's interesting. Right. That's fascinating. And maybe the demographic of people who do dive full into these immersive experiences, maybe they'll have something to share with the rest of us, just like the 18th century decadence movement folks did too. I mean, some of our favorite writers and authors came out of that movement, and that's just kind of interesting.
It is interesting. What characterized the 18th century decadence movement? I'm not embarrassed to say. I like asking questions. I'm unfamiliar with this term or this cultural phenomenon. So what was it? Where was it? What was going on? I mean, I understand, I've read a lot of French literature about, noblemen behaving badly and whatever. But is that the kind of stuff like obscene rich people shit, or like what are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's a little multifaceted. There are different ways to kind of get into that.
Who situate us? We're in London. We're in Paris. Who's being decadent and how?
Right. So in terms of art, this is why I love the concept of decadence. Because it relates to culture, but also art. You eat a cupcake that's just full of frosting. Oh, that's so decadent, right? But decadence also means the downfall of society because we've lost our moral compass. It means a lot of different things. And so that to me is just why it's such a fascinating term. But in the late 1800s, the book Against Nature was a catalyst for this broader movement. Are you familiar with Beau Brummel?
No.
There's this character. He actually was British. But he loved dressing up in the most outrageously fancy clothes of all time. And so he was a dandy. He was kind of like the original dandy. And it was interesting because he wasn't a wealthy person. He wasn't part of the upper classes. But he would dress up like this, kind of in a sense, in a way that would kind of mock them, but also kind of beat them at their own game. And it was just very interesting. And that kind of kicked off the whole dandyism thing. That to this day is still somewhat of a phenomenon. Well, you'll go to a poetry reading and you'll see some guy who's definitely flamboyantly dressed. Sometimes, you go to a basketball game and the basketball players will come out and, and they'll be decked out in this like fancy suit that's like way over the top. In different subcultures, there are places where people do still like do this dandyism thing. Decadence right now mostly is associated with the downfall of society and moral decline, right? But I do think that this strain of the late 18th century decadence movement really is kind of...
What do you mean movement? People were all about the dandyism and the over the camp, like camping it up, like just...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, I mean...
Where too? Where are we talking? We're talking about London and Paris?
Or yeah, everywhere? This is Western Europe. This is mostly a Western Europe phenomenon. But, God, I'm blanking on his name. Who's the guy who wrote Windermere's Fan? Oscar Wilde. Okay, so Oscar Wilde was like a part of this. And a lot of the people in that circle were also part of it, of this decadence movement, that it was just like very simply a rejection of everything that is natural, because we were just coming out of the romantic era. If I'm getting this correctly, I should go back and read some of my history on this, but romanticism was all about connecting with nature, being part of nature, that whole sort of thing. This was a rejection of that, and being into cities, being into literature and art in a very submersive way. It was submersing your life in the arts rather than thinking that you need to spend more time outdoors as a farmer. And clearly we see a lot of that today.
We see a lot of, say that last part again.
A lot of a rejection of nature and a turn towards cities and especially digital realities.
Yeah.
I mean, if you talk to like a younger person, it's so fascinating just how clearly they are part of this digital virtual world where their whole view of reality is it doesn't make sense without the internet. And I mean, I remember a time, obviously, when the internet didn't exist, and my whole view of the universe, I think, is painted by that versus someone who grew up and they always were playing video games on their mom's phone before they could talk, you know, which is definitely a thing.
Yeah, you know, okay, there's a lot of directions we can go in here. I'm trying to pick a suitable one. Well, they're all suitable. It's my podcast. I talk about whatever I want. But that, I think, is absolutely characteristic of our generation of occupying a reality that is fundamentally, inextricably digital. Like, it's just woven into every part of how people interact with each other now. How we even transact. Like, I went out for drinks with a guy yesterday and, you know, he paid for his drink in cash. And I just thought, like, I haven't seen that in a very long time. People just use Venmo. They use cards. They use, you know, everything is, well, you know, one person pays on their card and then you like Venmo your friends or whatever. Or in Europe, it's Revolut. But yeah, I mean, I think it's, we tend to like, as far as I know, like always be, say, oh, the TV is going to ruin kids or mm-hmm. radio is going to ruin kids or whatever is. But I do sort of feel in some ways that something really profound is going on with the short form video content, TikTok, Instagram Reels, YouTube Shorts. I might get into the game, too. I mean, it's a great way of reaching people. It's an art form in a way. Mm-hmm. It's low overhead, you know, you don't have to like go to a movie studio to produce what people would call a film now. Like there are YouTubers who just like make millions of dollars a year just like filming from their room. The costs are low. So I don't see tech like leaving, or it's not even just tech, but like everything, Venmo, Facebook, WhatsApp, the fact that you can like share your live location with someone, that you can like Google what a restaurant is and get directions. Like, I don't see that stuff leaving us anytime soon. I do know one guy, this guy, David Samuels, you'd probably like his writing. He does a lot of creative nonfiction. He was on this podcast, not to toot my own horn. And the episode, I think it was episode 5 called A Quiet Revolution, where he talked about, you know, throwing out his iPhone and like retreating into the forest. He moved out of Brooklyn and to like upstate New York. And just that's his thing. Like he likes it. There's animals mm-hmm. and grass and, you know, whatever else there is in upstate New York.
I have a little bit of a hot take about this, which
go, please. And then we'll get into the French literature side of things.
Oh, for sure.
But
I mean, kind of my hot take is that humans like to do a couple of things and they are universal and they don't change even with technology. We like to build things and tell stories.
Okay.
TikTok is a form of building something. And it's also a form of telling stories. You're building a video. You're building a product, and which is a creative product, which is, you know, and it's using your mind to create something.
Oh, bro, that's so smart.
It's an artifact, and you're telling a story at the same time. This is what we love to do. We like to gossip and build shit. And so TikTok satisfies that, you know, at a very basic level. I think that that's awesome. You know, I think that also it ideally it is forming a human connection with others. You know, it's all good fun. The problem is that right now we haven't been able to really figure out how to do, you know, IRL plus digital. And I have been corrected about this from people who like work in schools. Well, they will say that kids still hang out at lunchtime, you know, like everyone is still just as social as they've ever been. I think that online people talk a lot about how kids no longer know how to socialize and blah, blah, blah. They don't have friends. But like, you know, I think I just haven't talked to some teachers and people who like spend time in schools. I guess like maybe it hasn't been that radical of a change, but we do see on the margins, there are incel communities. There are people who just like there's a loneliness epidemic for people who are like 65 plus. There are problems. There really are problems. But I do think that there is definitely a way where we can healthily keep all of our digital tools and also keep friendships. You know, I think that there's a way to do that. And it may not be as, you know, challenging as people make it out to be. I just think that it might just, I mean, I don't know. It's like, imagine one app that doesn't let you spend more time on your phone than 2 hours a day, right? And maybe it becomes popular to download that. That's something that like a lot of people might buy into, but no.
You
like,
can set time limits on your iPhone.
Absolutely. Well, like
I have them, but I blow through them sometimes.
I was just going to say like not a lot of people are going to like ditch their phones and move out into the woods like that guy you were mentioning a second ago. Not a lot of people are going to do that realistically, but maybe a lot of people will just be like, you know, it's not cool to spend all day on your phones. I'm just not going to, you know, that's a thing that's a possibility.
It's, you know, it's interesting. Do you do video stuff or jokes review? Do you have like TikTok summaries of books or I don't know if you like you thought about
I
doing mean,
I,
that?
I don't. I've thought about it, but I have a podcast and I have done some short videos. I did a short film. I did a feature length film actually over COVID during that time when I was stuck at home doing nothing. I had two friends. And we were all like, hey, we had all this time. Let's like make a movie. So I've done digital stuff for sure. But I haven't done the TikTok, the short form stuff yet.
I haven't really done as much of it.
To be honest, I feel too old.
Yeah, I haven't dabbled either. Maybe I will, but you're not too old. I don't know. I'm just thinking about that. It was a very insightful comment, Peter, about building things and telling stories. That is absolutely human. And we tell ourselves stories all the time to make ourselves feel better, to explain things, to explain all kinds of stuff, you know? I mean, look at all the stories, and every aspect of humanity is basically one version or another of storytelling. TikTok just taps right into that. So yeah. It's not subtle either. Like you're creating a little story. So I got you. All right. Let's talk about the phenomenon of all these little French fucks, right? And I've, you know, my family is not French, but Francophone. And I've lived in Paris and whatever, but we're, you know, whatever. I'm still going to call them French fucks because it has a nice consonance to it. You have all these little French fucks in 17th, 18th century literature, 19th century too. Balzac was full of this. In fact, we'll use the example of Balzac, of Lost Illusions. Are you familiar with the book?
I read it a long time ago. I may or may not have read that.
All right. Well,
I'm a big fan though. I was anyway.
Whatever. This is a story that we see again. Basically, you have some kid who's like kind of poor, living in the countryside, moves into the city, becomes rich in the city, whether it's, you know, in the post-revolutionary decadent boom of, you know, the 1820s and 30s or whatever, or whether it's, you know, before that. You had, I forgot what year Dangerous Liaisons was published, but and well, Dangerous Liaisons has an altogether different plot, and it's also an epistolary novel. But anyway, there seems to be a theme in French literature of, not just French literature, we see in American literature too, of the kid moves into the city, gets corrupted by the city, and then moves back to the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, but not always, the kid is poor in the countryside, rich in the city, then somehow manages to lose the money in the city, or, you know, his wife dies, or in some cases both. In the case of Lost Illusions, it's both. The protein, among other things, is basically like the city is a morally corrupt and depraved place, and it's better to retire to the country. This is the sort of the theme of Gatsby. At the end, We had a bunch of Midwestern transplants who went and like settled in New York, basically, Gatsby was from Dakota. Daisy was from Louisville. She's not Midwest. That's the South. Whatever. Tom was from Chicago. I think Tom was from Chicago, even though he went to Yale. Anyway, none of them were from New York. They all, Jordan Baker wasn't from New York. They all ended up in New York. They behaved decadently and behaved badly. You know, Tom had his mistress. Gatsby had these crazy parties. And then at the end, someone died. Gatsby. Though I hold out for the fact that, you know, maybe he swam up to the top of the pool and that the funeral was staged. Oh, can you hear me? Oh, there we go. Here's an example of some guys, you know, they all lived in New York. That was fun. That was decadent. Mm-hmm. And then shit hit the fan. People died. People broke up and then they left the city. Same thing with Lucien in Lost Illusions. He's the narrator, little French boy from Angoulême, moves to the city, gets rich, you know, whatever. And then, you know, he has to leave the city in the end. I don't remember what happens at the end of Bel Ami. They made a horrible movie about it with Robert Pattinson. I think, well, Georges Duras just fucks like all of the wealthy women in Paris and moseys his way into high society. I'm trying to think at the end. Oh, no, at the end he does. He ends up marrying some noble, like courtesan or whatever. He successfully completed his mission, which was social mobility with the help of his little friend down south and a lot of charm. That's a separate thing. Anyway, sorry, I'm rambling. But the question is basically about this phenomenon of the kid moving into the city, getting corrupted by the city, and then leaving and then returning, a return to the countryside. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting is that I do think that times have changed to a very large degree. In one sense, that's just kind of screaming at me, is that you can move to a city and do a city thing, and then you can move out. But in all of that transition, no matter how drastic it is, you're still going to have your Facebook page. You're still going to have your Twitter. You're still going to have your Gmail. You might have the same job. And transportation is such that with a car, you can drive, you know, have friends, maintain friendships with the people who live over an hour away. So your life may fundamentally not change today if you move from the city to the country versus how it might have very, very, very drastically changed in the 1800s between the city and the country. So that's kind of one thing. Another thing that's interesting is that I do think that we're starting to actually like younger folks are, last time I checked anyway, still migrating towards cities at pretty drastic numbers. I think that like 100 years ago it was something like 10% of the world population lived in cities. Now it's something like 60% of the world lives in a city. I think that includes suburbs. But I mean the change between rural versus urban living has super drastically changed over the last 100-150 years. And I mean, I think that like part of what's happened is cities have just become more livable. I was just living in San Francisco, and there are things, and my wife and I had a child when we were there, which is actually kind of technically why we moved out because it's so expensive. But at the same time, like it wasn't bad. I mean, if it wasn't so expensive, we could have easily raised a kid in San Francisco. Her daycare was a block and a half away from our apartment. I would just walk down the hill to Valencia Street, and right there was a daycare, right? It was so convenient. We had a couple of corner stores within walking distance that had organic food, you know, right there, a block or two away. World-class coffee shops, also a block or two away. Like, the city amenities are for real, and they're amazing. That's San Francisco. I can't speak for all American cities like that, right? But, I mean, back in the day, cities were dirty, and you get diseases. There were rats. and just like nasty bugs, and you couldn't just call an exterminator. I think that a lot has changed over the last 100 years. Where city living now, like, it's not bad. It's not bad if you can make it work. I know for some people it can be very challenging, but like city living is pretty good. And like suburbia living, not that great. You don't have nearly the number of amenities or friendship opportunities or job opportunities, or I mean, on and on and on and on. If you can make it work, city living now, I think is great and going to hopefully even get better as soon as my optimism is that millennials will take local government positions, kick out all the geriatrics, and then all of a sudden we'll be able to like build more and do a lot of things with cities that are just overdue, I think.
Yeah. Well, okay, I want to play with the dirtiness, and we can leave the geriatrics aside. Most of them are going to die soon anyway. I'm kidding. That's not very nice. I have friends. I have a couple of good friends who are geriatrics. And, you know, more power to them. That was just sort of a mean-spirited quip. That was unnecessary. On the subject of the dirtiness, I think that, like, let's toy around with this. That was very much part of the appeal in some ways. I, for a long time in Sydney, was involved in rather, I don't know if heavily is the appropriate adjective. I was steeped in the underground rave culture of Sydney. You know, parties, wild parties under bridges and tunnels and in the bush. We call them like the bush in Australia is like desert, like uninhabitable, just fucking land.
Yeah.
Or like forest, I guess. It's funny because people call it the bush. There's like in a lot of cases, there's not that much like lush greenery, so there's not that many bushes. Anyway, that's irrelevant. The point is, I was involved in this underground rave culture, and a lot of these parties were very dirty. Like, we cleaned up afterwards, but they were, you know, everyone's on all kinds of drugs. They were, everyone's like sweating. They're like 12-hour parties in some cases. They go on for multiple days. And the dirtiness was part of the appeal. Similar vibes to, I imagine, why people go to like Tresor or the Kit Kat Club or whatever in Berlin. They don't want like a nice, clean, polished, sterile environment. They're looking for the opposite. And so when I'm thinking of Lucien in Lost Illusions or George in Bel Ami, or the, you know, the fucking, well, that's different. I was going to say the underground speakeasy in Gatsby, but that's also probably pretty clean. I guess what I'm playing around with here is that the dirtiness is one and the same with the moral depravity. People are going there because of the rats and the cockroaches and the whatever, and it's all exciting and fun. And that's part of the appeal, rather than like being in your small, quiet countryside village. I don't know. What do you make of this in American literature, in French literature, in any kind of literature? You've read more than I have. You definitely have. Well, I don't know for sure. Maybe you're lying, but I don't. It doesn't seem that way. You know what I mean? This phenomenon of like you go to the city and the city's kind of dirty and like it's cool because it's dirty and like that's exciting. But that the depravity and the decadence and the decline, the loose morals or lack of morals or whatever. Is because of, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, the dirt plays into it, is, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, one thing that is so interesting to me is that when you go to a city now, at least I'm just speaking in terms of America, but also Europe, they like, it's so hard to get into trouble. it's really so hard to get into. So I was at Amsterdam a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it's, so, you know, the red light district, it's very epic. It's kind of like what American cities dream of having in terms of like a seedy district, right?
Yeah.
But still, like, it's very clearly rule-based. There are clearly a ton of rules, clearly a ton of way to violate those rules and to be, you know, penalized for them, that sort of thing. In San Francisco,
It's hard to get in trouble. It's just, yeah, you just said there's rules. That would mean it's easy to get in trouble.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, kind of in a sense, like you are going to follow the rules because it's structured in such a way that you're naturally not going to break the rules. Right. Like, there are no like guns laid on the side of the road that are loaded that you kill somebody with, you know, it's very safe. It's very, and all cities are kind of like this, where there are so many ways that just keep
there's
you
not
safe
as much
naturally.
Danger. It's not dangerous.
And so
Paris in the 1830s was absolutely dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And city planners do this. Well, they will make it so that you think that you're having a radical night out, but really you're walking through some very safe streets. And I mean, this is how cities are designed. They're designed to be playgrounds in a sense, but safe playgrounds where you kind of can't get into too much trouble. But I mean, in terms of literature, I do think that I'm trying to reach for a great example, but like one thing that just keeps on my mind is On the Road by Jack Kerouac. Not necessarily one of my favorite. Yes, I mean, he's not my favorite beat by any chance, but he said some things that are pretty, like, you know, on point.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Go ahead with the Kerouac point.
Yeah, well, I mean, he did this thing where he was always going between traveling and going to big cities and going to like the ultra hubs of a big city, mm-hmm. and having this wild experience and hanging out with literally the craziest people that were alive at that time, the biggest personalities, right? And he documents all of this and ends up, you know, having like these decadent experiences, you could say. But there's this moment in On the Road where he is someplace, I think around Monterey, where he needed money, I believe. So he's working on a farm and he falls to his knees and like has his fingers in the dirt. And he's like, this is real. This is real life. I could be in this dirt for the rest of my life and settle here. And this is all that I need to be sustained as a person. Right. Which I think that one thing that's real about that is I do think that there is something about cities that is like, they are kind of fake in kind of a bad way. They don't yet provide us with real experiences.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're kind of like pseudo real experiences in a sense.
Yeah. It's smart. Yeah. Maybe the idea is that no one can live in a city forever. Is that what you're getting at? Like, of course these guys flamed out in the city, whether it was Gatsby and Daisy or you know, whatever French protagonist, because humans flame out in cities because there's no fucking such thing as a city. Like it's made up.
Yeah, totally. It's a simulation of what a house is. It's a simulation of what a street is. And they're all these simulations are piled on top of each other. Maybe, you know, like, I do think on a practical level, humans are going to keep migrating towards cities. Part of that is just because the suburbs, exurbs, and a lot of times small towns are just economically unsustainable. A lot of times suburbs are always on the verge of going bankrupt, at least in America, and they to sustain themselves with their tax base, they have to keep growing. And at some, you know, point, those are going to break and they just can't grow anymore because the infrastructure is just so expensive to maintain that they need an ever increasingly large tax base to maintain them. Whereas cities, you know, if you live in a city, you are taking up way fewer resources in terms of energy and resources, water and on and on and on and on than if you live in a suburb. And, you know, as we do, you know, we're kind of in this place where we want to, you know, look towards being more sustainable as a human species. That means living in a city and not a small town. So I do think that we should preserve all of our green spaces so that they're easy to access. I mean, this is one thing that I really do like about a town like San Francisco is that all you got to do is drive 10 miles in any direction outside of the city and you're in like kind of pristine, untouched land. To some extent, at least it feels that way. It gives that impression. Plus the beach, right? And so you can, you don't have to go too far to like see the real world and experience nature. Harder to do in New York, you know, unfortunately, but there are places where you can definitely have the best of both worlds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've made some progress here on the subject of cities and dirtiness and why this is a theme in literature. There is something, you know, biological. Who wrote that book, Against Nature?
Carl Wiesemann, H-U-Y. I believe that's how you
did you talk about this, or who was talking about this? Was that you?
I brought that up. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I have fucking memory problems. Too much red wine. Well, actually, I feel in some cases red wine helps with memory. But yeah, like, this is not natural. I mean, I fucking love Paris. I love New York. I love London. I'm flying to Buenos Aires and soon. I've never been there, but it looks beautiful from the pictures. But yeah, maybe they're, why do these guys at the end up back in the country? Why are we buried in the ground? I mean, there's lots of reasons for that, but just ideating, because it's, what was that? First of all, I'm Jewish, but there's that biblical verse, Genesis 3:19, maybe it's like, from dust thou came and, you know, into dust thou shall return, or what, mm-hmm. something to that effect, that we like came from dust and then we're going to just be dust again. That's interesting. Okay, on the subject of, well, I don't know, do you have anything to add here before I throw another question at you?
I think that's, I'm down to move on to the next topic.
Well, too bad.
You just went into the dust. Okay.
No, it's fine. Books. What are some of your favorites and why?
So one of my most recent favorites is Ant Kind by the film director, Charlie Kaufman.
Okay.
And it's one of the most phenomenal books that I've read. I'm so just shocked that it exists. It is, you know, this like 400 plus page tome that is kind of in the genre of like a postmodern book, because like self-aware of itself or whatever, like Charlie Kaufman's movies often are. But every single sentence is just like flowing with life and dripping with comedy and irony. And it's like this wonderful, wonderful piece of literature that is a little bit under the radar. But I have this test for books that he like completely clears the line, which is that I think that you should be able to pick up any novel to any page, to any paragraph, read a paragraph, and it should be entertaining. I think that that's okay. Like the ultimate marker for what a good novel is. Too many novels these days, I think, literally are just so safe, and they have like, in American literature, there's this voice. It's this very toned down, muted, understated voice that's very like Bret Easton Ellis. I even like him as a writer sometimes, but it's just like taking Hemingway's work and just going to the most boring place with it. This is 99.9% of American novels right now. There are so few people that have a very clear, energetic voice to themselves. To throw out another book that passes this test, I think, is My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Moshbeg, Otessa Moshbeg. Mm-hmm. Also satisfies this test. You can take that book, you can open it up to any page, you'll chuckle, you know, if you read a paragraph or two, you'll just start chuckling. It's just so fantastic and relevant and modern. There really aren't too many modern books like that I've seen. I would have to start, you know, naming classics to really add to this list. But those are two that I would definitely recommend to anybody who's into modern literature.
Okay. What about the classics? You know, I've never read James Joyce. It's kind of, I don't think embarrassing is the right word, but I am disappointed in myself. I'm literally looking at the portrait of the Portrait of a Young Artist as a Young Man right now. It's been sitting on the bookshelf. I haven't read it. Have you read Joyce? And
quite a bit. Yeah, I would actually skip the artist of as a young man. It's a great concept. I would read the Wikipedia for it of why it's amazing, because it is amazing. But then I would honestly, I'd skip to Ulysses. Ulysses is one of the most fantastic texts ever written. It's bananas how awesome it is. It's boring at times, clearly, obviously, but it's also the most lively prose that it probably exists on the face of the planet. It'll blow your mind. It's amazing.
Interesting. Okay. Why? Well, without plot spoiling.
No, I mean, like, yeah, there's kind of no plot to spoil. I guess it's like a day in the life, like June 16th or whatever in this dude's life.
This is Ulysses we're talking about.
Yeah, Ulysses. So, James Joyce, for that book, he manages to take a million different styles and throw them into one book and make it work. Where, I mean, it's like an action movie at times. It is like a dense PhD thesis at times. It's a pop novel at times. It's a romance, it's like a seedy romance at times. It has a little bit of everything, and it's all stylized to the point where it's almost shocking that one dude wrote it. And at the same time, it's also not cheesy. It's very real and authentic and feels timeless. You know how like you listen to like a Bob Dylan record? There's just, for whatever reason, there's just something timeless about it. Not all of them, but most of his records just feels timeless. Ulysses is like that, where it just feels timeless. And that to me is just something that's so rare.
I've just finished the book I'm currently reading, so that Ulysses might just be next.
I read it over about a year because I didn't want to pressure myself to like go through it. So it was one of those books that before I went to bed every night, I would just read two pages, you know, which again is part of my whole, like, I have a short attention span, but I'm still going to make it work lifestyle.
Oh, you know what I have to read too is The Unbearable Lightness of Being. I think it takes place in Argentina.
That is a great book. Yeah.
Is it Eastern Europe?
It takes place in Eastern Europe.
Oh, well, okay. There's a lot of Italians in Argentina.
Kundera, yeah. I love Kundera.
Yeah. I couldn't comment.
you'll like him too. He's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, let's talk about the singularity. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, so I won't pepper you with too many questions. But this is disconcerting, man. The robots are going to fucking kill us and then use us to, I don't know, for nefarious purposes. What's going on? What is the singularity?
Okay, well, yeah, I guess for context, a couple of years ago, I wrote the Singularity Survival Guide.
Yeah.
I started working on that project as a very sincere take on, like, a survival guide for what happens if robots unironically take over. Mm-hmm. But it was just so boring and so requiring so much research, I abandoned it, and I abandoned it several times. But there was a moment when I realized that, oh wait, like this could be a joke, you know, like this could be funny. And so I found a voice for it there's this book by J.P. Dunleavy called The Unexpurgated Code, and it's all these short chapters about how to live properly, but in like this humorous way. So it's you know, like, how to pick up ladies at the local pub, you know, it's that sort of a thing. But you know, how to smoke your cigars so you don't look like an asshole. It's that sort of a thing. Short chapters, but this phenomenal voice that he pulls off. I kind of stole his tone and that style, or was inspired by that tone and style, I should say. And so I wrote this book called The Singularity Survival Guide, and it's written as if it were written by a program. So these programmers in Silicon Valley asked or developed this program that was going to spit out this text for how to survive when the robots take over, right? And so it spits out this text. There's a goofy backstory. I won't belabor the point, but the survival guide is written by this robot and tells you how to survive when the robots take over. And it's actually kind of like real advice, but it's just presented in a silly manner. But I do think that this is a real conversation that is important to have. That robots, AI, I mean, it's getting more and more intelligent all the time, clearly, with ChatGPT and all these things. We haven't really figured out, one, how to incorporate the technology that we have right now, and two, we haven't figured out how to, you know, even have these conversations about the next generation of these technologies. And so what's happening right now and what's going to continue to happen is just very smart, ambitious, well-resourced individuals are going to start, you know, amassing these tools and building companies based on them. And governments, I think, are going to be left a little bit behind because governments just move so slowly. Yeah. So, I think that it's going to be really interesting just, you know, what businesses develop out of these things, how many people lose their jobs, and if we're able to, you know, move forward over the next decade without, you know, mass social unrest because of it. I think that it could be all for the good of humanity, but there are multiple ways in which it could turn, you know, badly for us.
Yeah, that's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
Like, as a writer, okay? I mean, if you can just feed someone all your favorite fucking novels, right? If I, like, give this guy Brady Stenellis and Bukowski and whatever, I haven't even read much Norman Mailer, but let's just say we throw all, like, the great sort of macho writers, and you give this AI, not macho is not the appropriate word, but I'll list some, you know, whatever. You give the guy like Tom Wolfe, Joan Didion, mm-hmm. Hunter Thompson, Bukowski, and then like all the fucking lyrics of Warren Zevon. And you let the AI do whatever it's going to do with that. And then you're like, write me a story about guy who's 50 and he's depressed. And then, you know, whatever, like there's just so much to draw from. I can't read the entirety of literature, but the AI can. It can read way faster mm-hmm. than I can, like in a matter of seconds. And so, or maybe longer than seconds, I don't know, and then spit something out. So like with ChatGPT, you know, kids are going to cheat on their high school essays. That's in some cases, I think, you know, I don't know, whatever. I don't think that's a huge deal. Like make mm-hmm. them write the essay in class and then chat. Whatever, there's solutions to that. But like, I don't know, what do we think about ChatGPT's effect on writers or filmmakers? You know, you fucking say you want to see Tom Cruise getting gangbanged by Ninja Turtles, you can just plug in to the AI, make me a deep fake of Tom Cruise getting gangbanged by Ninja Turtles or whatever, and then you don't need to spend millions of dollars filming something like Babylon, for mm-hmm. example, or something like well, on the subject of Damien Chazelle, La La Land or Whiplash, those take fucking a lot of money to film that. You know, a lot of the sets, there's cameramen, the get a feed, the whole thing. It's a labor intensive thing. Or you could stay at home on your computer and program the AI to do it. Now, we're not there yet. Again, the VR stuff I did wasn't as far along as I thought it was. And I don't imagine that, you know, deep fakes video creation is either. But like, everyone's talking about generative AI. How do you think this will affect our livelihoods as men of arts and letters, Peter?
So, I mean, I do like to be optimistic about these things. I mean, for one thing, it's just interesting. A couple of months ago, I spoke with a guy who was the digital director. I'm not sure exactly what his title was, but for the film Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yeah.
And so that film, if you see it, it looks like it's a Marvel movie at times, where you would think that they would have Marvel level studio resources, like a team of 100 people doing the visual effects. They had, I think, 6 guys working on that. And it was in this dude's like spare bedroom in Los Angeles. And they just like cobbled this thing together and it looks absolutely amazing. That wasn't necessarily because these are, you know, superhumans, but because they had kind of superhuman level tools. And I mean, a lot of those VR jobs that people do, they're kind of like boring slog jobs. I had a roommate one time that this is in San Francisco. He'd come home and I was like, hey, what were you up to all day? And he was like, oh, well, I was designing a lamp for a video game. You know, he spent all day designing a lamp. There was in the corner of some room in some dumb video game, right? kind of a waste of time at some level, you know? Like, I'm sure that guy had really big ideas and grand visions, but he designed a lamp for a video game that day. I think that we'll be able to use these tools, creative people can use these tools to express their grand visions without needing 100, you know, Marvel VX workers to get it, you know, pulled off. That's the part of, like, my optimism, is that I think that we can, you know, be empowered by these tools. I do think that it will probably also cheapen a lot of the creative output that we have, because, I mean, I don't know. I think that, like, we need savant human beings at the helm of creating our great films and our great books. And I hope that whatever, you know, AI brings us and allows us to do, I hope that it's not like a bunch of mediocre people who are just like happen to be, you know, tapped into the VR resources or whatever that allows them to create things. But I don't know. I think that humanity will always have, you know, weird visions, and we will use the tools of the day to make those into creative projects. Will people lose their jobs though? Like definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, but also new jobs will be created.
And new jobs will be created. Absolutely. Yeah.
And there's the whole quality assurance thing too. I forget where I was reading about this. Maybe Alex Hormozi or Hormozi, however you pronounce it, the guy with the big calves. But yeah, like quality assurance. Like if they can read all of those great authors I said and then produce a story and then I go in and like massage it, that's still... it's still art, you know, and like people's tastes change. I mean, this is why
some people were upset with Andy Warhol, right? Because he kind of like cheated in a sense. But he kind of rose above that by being a character in and of himself. Imagine if Andy Warhol was just like not interesting as a person. People probably wouldn't have cared so much about his art, but he became a socialite in Manhattan and, you know, hung out with Edie Sedgwick and all these like super glamorous people. If he didn't have that social life, I don't think that his art would have been quite as impactful or even remotely as impactful. There's something about being a cool person that, like, this, it sounds so stupid to say, right? But someone who's a cool person, people want to associate with them because being associated with cool people makes you cool. That coolness rubs off on you. So it's not even about, like, the art at some level. It's about, like, a cool person doing something that you can associate with that person.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you look at Joan Didion with that epic picture of her with a cigarette, she's all like emaciated in a t-shirt holding a cigarette. Like, who cares what the fuck she wrote? She looks so good that like people want to read her books. Like, just people will pick up a book just because that is on the back cover of it. That sounds dumb, but it's also completely true.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just firing. Like on. Marketing, like, yeah, your jacket cover fucking matters. On my jacket cover on my book, I have like leopard print pants on, and nice. Now like I happen to wear leopard print pants in other aspects of my life, but like it's, I don't know, I liked it. It's better than like wearing a suit, I think. And Tom Wolfe would go around in his white suit, and that was like part of the thing. That was his thing. He's marked himself as an outsider. So actually I have the Bonfire of the Vanities. Maybe I should read that next. But anyway, yeah, I think that absolutely, like, being a cool fucking interesting person, like, you are your brand, you know?
Yeah.
Warhol tapped into that. Didion, to some extent, tapped into that. Though her and her husband John, they hosted parties and such in San Francisco, but they, I don't know. Didion in some ways is like quaint. I don't know if that's the right word. I think it's appropriate. I wrote my thesis on Didion. Well, on Hunter Thompson, John Didion, and George Plimpton. But there was a chapter about Didion. I think quaint might be the right word. Yeah. I don't know. Well, I do know. I think absolutely the art and the artist in a lot of these people is one and the same.
Yeah. Oh, I think so too. I do think that being an artist is always going to be part of, you know, being a human, no matter what creative tools exist. So for example, you know, my one of my favorite mugs that I drink coffee out of, like almost literally every day, is it was created by my wife's friend in San Francisco who has, you know, a pottery kiln thing. You know, she does pottery. It's just cooler than all the other mugs that we have. I just really like it. It's got that human touch that's also just very special. I think that art will always have that, even if we could completely replicate her mug a million times. Who cares? Because mine is the one and only. I think that we will start to consider artists to be more craftsmen again, where it's just cool to have like the local honey from the local honeybee guy that you're, you know, putting on your toast from the local artisan baker guy. Yeah. That like on and on and on and on, because there's just something just fun about that and just real and like connecting that is just ingrained in us, because we're animals, you know, we are just like, you know, goofy animals. And I think that having human connections is always going to be important to us.
That's an excellent point. And I do like the fucking organic farmer's market, whatever, like better than processed.
Like, honest to God, the worst lifestyle in the world is the American who lives in the suburbs, never walks, only eats fast food, goes to the movies, they're living like a very lame version of the 18th century decadence movement, where they're experiencing all fakeness. But it's not only fakeness, it's like mass produced fakeness. It's corporate fakeness. And there's something just soulless about that, that I know people like that. I feel sorry for all of them, because there's something dead about that life that so many people are leading. And it's just not that hard to just not have that experience, to live in a neighborhood that's walkable, to have a coffee shop where you know the name of the barista, to, you know, just certain things, just very, very small tweaks to your lifestyle. Then all of a sudden, maybe you still have like some decadent life in a sense, where you're like living in fakeness and some like simulation of reality. But maybe it's just like a cool artisanal simulation rather than a corporate bland simulation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't want to know people like that.
Yeah.
It's not nice to say. I don't want to spend any time around them. It's so disgusting to me. Like and I think disgusting, I don't use that word lightly, is the appropriate word. I am revolted by the fast food, the sedentary lifestyle. Like, I mean, people can do whatever they want. I don't want to pass judgment, but I don't want to do it. And I don't want to be around other people who are just like, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Like, you know what? They're like a perfectly good class of people who like live in the suburbs and, you know, drive their kids to school and then drive them home and go to the movies and eat, you know, Wendy's and Arby's and Long John Silver's and Red Lobster and the like. But like, it's just so, I mean, on the subject of Andrew Tate, is a problematic guy. I probably shouldn't even say his name. It'll get the podcast blacklisted. But for what everyone thinks about his views, one of his main talking points is some of which are rather objectionable, but not all of them. Like, one idea of his that I think is interesting is this idea of the Matrix. And Andrew Tate didn't come up with this. Noam Chomsky wrote Manufacturing Consent, I think, in 88. Joan Didion wrote Political Fictions in 2000. Matt Taibbi wrote this book called Hate, Inc. And they were all sort of talking about politics and media and how the issues we're discussing are not really the issues. They were decided upon ahead of time by a little oligarchy, and then they're spoon-fed to us, and we act as if we have a choice in the matter. It's the exact same thing, or we think that we have a choice in the matter. Like, why we're talking about this issue today, we act like, oh, well, I chose to. You absolutely did not choose to. This was like a concerted effort. There was sort of a consensus that this is what we want people to talk about, and then it's spoon-fed to people. So these guys living in the suburbs, I'm just thinking about, like, you go to Wendy's or whatever that has like they know exactly how to market to you. They have their deals, or, you know, they have all that shit. You go to like Costco. I was in Costco. Costco is the height of decadence. And like, I'm not, it provides a service. People need to buy food for cheap and that's fine. But like when people go to Costco, in my experience, you do not go to Costco with like, maybe you go with a shopping list, but like there's all the samples. It's just it's a whole fucking, I could write a short story about Costco. It's just an insane place. Like the, you know, the warehouses, it's the same kind of thing on Chomsky, Diddy and whatever. That's, they're talking about like politics. This is just like, all these things are just, people have like got their plugs into you and you're just providing them with cash, whether it's the corporations, this whole lifestyle, is just completely catered to by corporations. And I don't know, I just don't like it. And yeah. It's beyond disliking, because that is different. I'm not trying to be like xenophobic against the idea of it. Xenophobic is not even the word, but like afraid of something that's different. It's more, I think it's not good. I think it's not a productive way to live. Even if you're like a fucking high school teacher, like you're doing a nurse, like you're doing something that's like good, fundamentally like good for humanity or whatever. It's just, I don't know, maybe that level of fakeness is too much. Or maybe I'm just being a snob because I'm more okay with the fakeness of New York.
Well, you know, I have a funny experience or anecdote about this, which is that, and the moral, the cause of the chase, is that I think that just because something is fake now, give it a little bit of time and it might become interesting. There's a song by Pete Seeger, the folk singer, called Little Boxes. And it's about this suburb of San Francisco called Daly City, where there was Levittown in New York, and then there was this Daly City thing, where it was one of the first mass-constructed suburbs in America where every single house looks the same. So the song Little Boxes on the Hillside, blah, 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 and everyone lives the same lifestyle, everyone has the same, wears the same clothes, drives the same cars, goes to the same work, goes home. So it's like a parody of this, or making fun of this lifestyle. When I first moved to the Bay Area, I lived in one of those houses on the hillside in Daly City. And in one of those like boxy houses that they're all the same in every neighborhood, you can drive forever, all the houses look the same, except when I did a short film about this, enough time has passed, that this community has become very weird, just like goofy. Where it's no longer white people. It was designed to only be white people. Now it's like 70% Filipino. And like I lived in this house with this Filipino guy, this Filipino couple. And when you walk into their house, it's the most like colorful, vibrant, like artsy place I've ever been in my entire life. And it's so not that song. Like, and the only thing that happened really was just time passed. And so something that is boring and even designed to be boring, I don't know, give it enough time. People are weird. People will fuck up normality and make it weird. And that's just something that I really like about humans. I don't know if that's going to be the case with Costco necessarily, but like, look at Kmart. Like, I don't even know if Kmart still exists, but it was a boxy store that became weird. It became like weird. And then I think it went away. But like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, we will take things and make it weird, whether like that entity likes it or not. That's one of the funny things about humanity. But it takes weird people to do that. I don't know. I don't know.
We are weird.
I do
people,
worry about
though.
The norm cores.
Yeah. What is the norm core? What is that? Like the sheeple?
The sheeple. That's another term for it. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Like, maybe I should call this like getting weird with Peter Clark or something, making things weird. Like, we're humans. Yeah, we can't live in the boxes forever. I actually, you know, I found this to be interesting. There's this town in Alaska. I saw this on the internet. I don't know if this is true, like on a meme or something, but I think it's true. Where everyone lives in like one building. The entire town lives in this one
whoa.
Fucking massive building.
Oh, whoa.
And it's a small town. I don't know, a couple thousand people or a few thousand people. And it's just like so fucking dystopian to me. But like, did you ever, there's a book that came out in the 50s, I think, called The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. There was that Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Blanchett, not Titanic. Maybe it wasn't Kate Blanchett. What's the movie? Run River. That's a Dennis Lehane film. We need to Google this. This is important.
Ooh, I'm not familiar. Yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio movie. 1950s suburbs. Revolutionary Road.
Oh, okay. I never saw it, but I know about it.
Interesting one. Good one. Anyway, not much more to add there, but this is when I look at like Costco or a mall, some suburban mall with just like hundreds of cars parked in the parking lot and families usually hanging out at the mall, like there's the food court, they have lunch, they make like a whole day out of the mall trip, and like that's like that's exciting for them. It just gives me the ick.
I mean, it's interesting.
It just feels like the height of decadence, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. There's this philosopher, Baudrillard, who's one of my favorites, and he describes America in a very interesting way in terms of simulation and simulacra. He has a book by that title. And there's this concept where if you're in Disneyland and you look around, it's all fake houses, it's all fake streets. Everything is fake and is designed that way. It's a simulation of what a real house is. It's a simulation of a real street, that sort of thing. But if you pull out from that and look at LA, it's the same thing. The streets are just copies of copies of copies of other streets. The houses, same thing. I mean, we've been building the same general type of a house for thousands of years. It's all just a simulation. It's, oh, we saw somebody else do that, let's do that here. And that's what modern civilization is. We're just like recreating simulations. Which is why I think when you stumble upon something that is like authentically like bespoke, we were just in New Orleans, right? When you walk down the French Quarter, it's a weird place because it was created with a bunch of different historical reference points. And it for a while there almost died, and then it was kind of like revitalized. There's so much history and real life there that you can't really call that a simulation of anything, because it's kind of like risen above that to become like an authentic place. I think that we do need to continue to value authentic places like that as humans without like somehow turning them into museums. When you walk around San Francisco right now, it feels like a museum city, just like a lot of like European cities. They feel like museums a little bit. That's another like weird balance that we need to somehow, I think, get right. Is to make cities still like be alive and be authentic without being museums. But even that, even the most museum-y city in the world is still just more interesting and more fun to be in than your generic strip mall in America, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Just America, like, it's awesome. It's gigantic in so many ways. Not just the size, but just the portions, everything. Like, and I don't think it's, I think it's in some ways decadent in a way that's not cool. In a way that is not, I don't know, but I'm also very much against like a religious revival, or like, I don't know how familiar you are with like, well, we don't need to get into this, but like the, you know, the NatCon movement and Yoram Hazony and like this idea that the solution to the decadence is restoration of moral order. I don't know. I kind of like the depravity of Berlin or the depravity of Paris or whatever. And I think that, yeah, as you said at the very beginning, decadence is not. It comes in many shapes and flavors, and you could call a mall in central New Jersey decadent, but you could also call like a lavish black tie event in New York decadent. So I guess I guess, yeah, decadence comes in different shapes and forms, is the consensus.
All of life is insanely decadent right now compared to what it used to be 100 years ago, just in terms of all the things that we have that are free, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You own a cell phone. You have access to the internet. You have all the resources in the world, all the knowledge in the world is completely free at your fingertips. And that's something that is just like, we don't even know what to do with that. It's just crazy. Like, I can't even wrap my mind around that. It's nuts.
It's cool. Anyway, that wraps up things for me. We talked about like a fucking wide range of things. Thank you for bearing with me. Is there anything that you wanted to, where can we find you? First of all, what are the handles and the platforms and such?
I'm on Twitter. Yeah. Hey, Peter Clark, HeyPeterKe.
Okay.
I have a fairly new Substack that's pertinent to this conversation. It's called The Decadence Project.
Oh, sick.
Where I explore a lot of these different topics. And I also have a fairly new-ish podcast called Team Futurism. That's on YouTube and Apple and Spotify and all the usual places. Those are the places you can mostly look me up these days.
Yeah.
If you are a literary-minded person and you're listening to this, I would also say check out Jokes Review. It's jokesliteraryreview.com. That's my literary journal, and we do some awesome things. We publish books, maybe like one book a year, and they're all like very esoteric, artsy works. And I'm trying to build like a cool community over there of like outsider, like goofy thinkers. So join me over there as well. Feel free to reach out to Jokes Review, follow us on Twitter, and just say hey.
Awesome. Well, I'll be subscribing.
And, oh, please do. Yeah, yeah. I feel like you'd fit in.
Thanks.